So restarting even earlier, we'd hoped, Ms. Bobias, tell me what the answer to the question I put to Mr. Jones and LMS is.
In terms of the northern part of the rezoning?
The lower terrace,
yep,
of the Lake Mackay Partnership, now Lake Mackay Partnership land on the north side of Atkins Road.
And remind me of your question, please, sir.
The question was, having spent a lengthy period talking about to Mr. Barr about defensible boundaries at Hawea, if we were to agree with your recommendation that the settlement land come down into the lower terrace, is that a defensible boundary, and what's going to happen next in terms of expansion of Hawea, of Luggett, rather, northward, probably over the state highway, every which way?
So, as Mr. Jones talked about yesterday, it wouldn't be a defensible boundary.
What would I say then?
In my view, it wouldn't be a defensible boundary. And there has been a little bit of confusion. The landscape evidence that was lodged with the submission from Mr. Espy was written under the assumption that Luggett would have an urban growth boundary. And that was clarified in my section 42A, that Luggett is not proposed to have an urban growth boundary, and there's not scope, in my view, there's not scope to put one on through submissions. So Mr. Jones had been working under the assumption that there was an urban growth boundary.
Oh, yes.
Yep. So what I would like to do is obviously to hear Mr. Espy when he appears, but I would like to revisit that in my reply, and with the view to, if we are recommending to approve the rezoning, then there would be a zone boundary treatment there that would create a defensible boundary.
The thought that occurred to me, the most defensible zone boundary might be the BRA at the escarpment and leave the lower terrace.
Possibly, yes.
Rural residential.
Possibly, yes. Yes. So I would like to revisit that in my report.
So, okay. Starting with your evidence in chief, your topic one, discussing special provisions for staff accommodation. Mm-hmm. And the question that occurred to me, thinking about the relief that Cadrona Alpha Resort and Wayfair are seeking, is whether, if the plan provides for staff accommodation, do the effects of staff accommodation of residential properties used for staff accommodation differ if they are converted to permanent resident accommodation? And if they don't, would it even be possible to decline an application down the track to convert staff accommodation to general residential accommodation?
Yeah, I think it would be quite difficult to do, particularly if you were. If we were to accept the relief sought, because it would be a purpose-built facility for worker accommodation, and that to my mind sets it apart from staff accommodation that is provided for, say, in conjunction with a visitor accommodation activity. So I think there would be difficulty. I think it would be difficult to differentiate.
Oh, well, we'll ask Mr. Farrell about that. See if he's got any bright ideas. Limits on the GFA. Am I right that you've shifted ground and recommend acceptance of the submission?
Correct. So in my rebuttal,
that was my impression, I just wanted
to... It is, that's correct. So it's the GFA limits wouldn't apply to those ancillary activities.
Going on to the discussion of regionally significant infrastructure, that...
Could I have a paragraph reference here?
Oh, sorry, in paragraph 7.
Thank you.
Well, section 7.
Section 7, thank you.
Particularly 7.8, that the notified policy would be problematic for overhead lines present in settlements. I wondered if there's an analogy to be drawn with the Environment Court's reasoning in the Topic 2 appeals dealing with farming in O&Ls, that they don't effectively, if you define the values of the O&L as including the farming, then continued farming is by definition not adverse to values, and you're continuing to protect those values. So as an analogy, if you already have settlements with overhead power lines in substance, what's a few more lines?
Yeah, sure.
Whereas, well, I'm not sure if there are any settlements that have undergrounded lines, but if they're already undergrounded, then putting them above ground is quite a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this a solution in search of a problem?
I have addressed it in my rebuttal,
yes.
In terms of a recommended amendment. So that's at section 4 of my rebuttal.
Yeah, just take me to the amendment.
And the provisions?
Yep. Where is that?
So that's at policy 20.2.2.6.
20.2.6.
And that has narrowed it down to, rather than being regionally significant infrastructure as was sought in the original submission, has narrowed the focus of it down to electricity sub-transmission infrastructure or significant electricity distribution infrastructure.
Those are defined terms, aren't they?
They are, yes.
And now, they are now.
They are now.
Yeah, because that's come through the consent, consent orders.
So that's refined it down, and that's... what I was seeking in my 42A was refinement down to those specific things.
Basically, to big lines.
Basically, yeah.
Um, 8.18. I wondered whether the second sentence was required, the second sentence of the suggested text was required, given that, wouldn't you do that anyway? Wouldn't you always take a cumulative view to the activities that are occurred?
Really for the avoidance of doubt. And I believe that in the operative district plan provision for the township zone, it has the same wording. But I did an R as to whether to include that, but I decided to recommend including it for the avoidance of doubt.
That would suggest that there is a good reason, because otherwise somebody might argue that the omission was itself material.
Correct.
When you say confusion, is that a variation of the same point, that if this one was specific, then it might be open to argue that because this one identifies it, if it's not identified elsewhere, it doesn't mean that.
Correct. Yes, that's right. I understand that that's how they are meant to be interpreted, and I think I'm obviously constrained by scope here in terms of just applying to the rule that's for the settlement zone, but that is how it is meant to be interpreted.
But if one rule said it did, then that would certainly imply the rest didn't. The rest don't.
And that's the issue with the iterative changes to the district-wide chapters. Okay.
I wondered. Paragraph 9.1, I wondered if the association has the wrong focus, that there it's not the RDA which is going to change the character, it's the permitted activity at 450, which suggests that even if the the submission were granted, that still wouldn't have the effect that they're seeking.
In terms of the shift from an 800 square metre minimum to 450?
Yeah.
I would agree with that, sir. Thank you. I think it's above it. Yes, it doesn't sit in the it's not embedded in the table. Yes. Thank you.
Looking at roof pictures. Your paragraph 10.7, talking about didn't understand what it mattered that 25 degrees was a minimum.
Yes.
Because a minimum difference from the horizontal, because it seemed to me that Blackthorn wanted the ability to have less than that.
My reading of the Blackthorn submission was that we were prescribing a pitch of 25 degrees, and that was an incorrect interpretation. Whereas the rule is a minimum pitch of 25 degrees, so it gives flexibility for different roof pitches, but 25 is the minimum.
Just not a, not flexibility for a flat roof.
Correct.
I wondered what point you were making was it saying that Cadrona functions more as a settlement rather than being focused on just providing for visitors.
Yes, so that sets it apart from the rural visitor zone, which is what, so Cadrona under the operative district plan is zoned rural visitor zone.
Gotcha.
And that's a key difference between the settlement zone and the rural visitor zone, is the provision for residential activities in the settlement zone.
And the changes made from the ODP rural visitor zone to the to the PDP one would exemplify that, because pushing more, but it's a limited scale and operation.
Correct. And the Cadrona, and that's partly why there are some Cadrona specific provisions in the settlement zone, which brings in some of the operative district plan rural visitor zones provisions, including increased height.
Including?
Increased height, 12 metre height limit, compared to the other settlements.
Talking about the village green at Cadrona, who owns that land? Do we have any idea what they want to do with it?
That question I think has come up in the submission. It's not owned by council. I've spoken to a council parks officer, and there aren't any immediate plans to purchase that land. However, I think that having it there in the design guide as an aspirational village green, I don't see an issue with having that there.
Is it owned by the pub?
I actually don't know. It's currently used as the pub car parking.
Well, that's why I assumed.
Yeah, so that may be the case.
It was, but
I think it is.
I'm going to Lake Mackay. Two issues at 13.3. I wondered about, like, this is, these issues have been pretty much solved by the submitter backing off its challenge to the BRA.
Yes.
But the margin south of the border, it doesn't seem to match the shape in the plan maps.
Okay, I was
can I ask you to check that?
Yep.
Where they're suggesting that a chunk be shaved off the zone, it doesn't much matter if it continues to be the subject of a BRA and it's reducing the zone. But just to my eye, it didn't seem to have the same shape, and so I wonder if it's in the right place. And then there's the question I asked Mr. Jones. Have you got any idea how wide that on the far right map, how wide that strip they're pushing west is on the ground?
I don't have a width, but I can. This image is taken from the submission, so it's not an image that we've generated. But I can find that number for you and
give that
figure to you. So right. it's the blue area, and
Correct. It's running north to south. Really, just that we have an idea of scale. We'll put it another way. Because Mr. Kemp, who was guiding us around the around the sites, had GPS on his phone. He told us where it was, and we paced it out. But I don't want to be relying on something that we found ourselves on a site visit. I want you to tell me.
I can certainly provide that figure, sir.
And that was all I had. Have you changed your mind, Commissioner?
No.
With regard to the discussion I had prior about the Villa Alphans of the Wayfair Group and staff accommodation.
Yes.
I'm just trying to understand your thinking in terms of you say there was no evidential basis provided for the relief sought, there was no capacity modelling or impact reports provided, and that was one of the reasons why you didn't support it.
Yes.
If that was forthcoming, would that change your...
I would certainly be able to consider some evidence there in terms of being able to do a cost-benefit analysis. I should probably point out too that
Because you did mention it would add significant complexity. I'm just trying to test if that's the...
Yeah, I mean, it's a discretionary activity consent to breach the 800 square metre minimum density rule, and that's rule 20.5.1. So my view is that the settlement zone provisions would provide a consenting pathway for denser forms of residential development, albeit it would be via discretionary activity consent. And the Wayfair submission and the Cadrona submission are seeking a more permissive framework than the discretionary activity that's provided in the settlement zone currently.
And with it, so essentially you're saying that and I don't want to put words in your mouth, because it's entirely you, but given the modelling and the evidence, there is a consenting pathway that's available. So
there is a consenting pathway, and those matters, including infrastructure, would be able to be considered on a case-by-case basis through a discretionary activity consent.
Thank you. Just as an aside, when we did visit the site, there's a massive big offal pit, rubbish dump that's in the middle of it that maybe you can pass on the regulatory committee. But northern portion, which is, and it's just to emphasise potentially the thinking behind BRA being a potential defensible edge of that, versus crossing at control, and you can see it is
That's correct.
Planned for, and it would, but if it, if we were to potentially look at the VRE as being the
That's certainly one of the options that I will be considering, and also talking to Mr. Jones about in terms of any amendments to his evidence.
That's all from me, thank you.
One last thought. Page 50 of your 42A report, you will note that between the, this is the stage one map.
Yes.
Between the rural residential and the white area, which is the old township, there is a triangle of rural land.
There is, and there isn't scope to amend that zoning at this stage, but that will certainly be something that we can look at and we can...
I was merely drawing it to your attention because...
It has been on my radar.
Because the stage one panel identified that too, and there was no scope to fix that there either.
Still no scope.
Still no scope. You just put that in the institutional memory as one something to address in due course. But that's it for us. Thank you very much for
your
input. We appreciate that. And for your patience listening while we...
Oh, you're very welcome. It was actually a real treat to sit back for a while. So, thank you. Would you like a seat?
Can we have a conversation later about your definition of the word treat?
Thank you.
I think you owe Mr. Barr for providing you with that entertainment.
Oh, it was great. I think you... I owe everybody a thank, mate. We're all part of that. Okay, Ms. Devlin is next. You should have two statements.
Oh no, just one.
Yeah, sorry. Section 42A in rebuttal. Does everyone have a summary?
Yes, thank you.
Over to you. So I'll just start reading from section one of my summary, I guess.
Indeed.
I have assessed and made recommendations on submissions requesting settlement and lower density suburban residential rezonings. I recommend a commercial precinct be applied over three additional submitter sites in Glenorchy. That's the Glovers, Blackthorn Limited and Purnamu Holdings. I consider that these commercial precinct extensions are appropriate in these specific locations for enabling small-scale commercial activities in the underlying settlement zone. These three additional commercial precincts will implement the objectives and policies of the underlying zones and are the most appropriate way to achieve the strategic direction of the PDP and are the most appropriate way to achieve the purpose of the RMA. And since filing my rebuttal evidence, I've been made aware of the consent order on topic 12, natural hazards. And so I went through and sort of checked where I got to on that, and I noted that a couple of policies referred to in my rebuttal evidence for the submission from Cadrona Village Limited had been deleted. But the objectives I've relied on have been retained but renumbered. My recommendation on submission 31019 was based on Mr. Bond's expert evidence and my uncertainty over whether the level of increased downstream flooding as a result of the rezoning request would be significant and or intolerable. I consider that my recommendation is still supported by Chapter 28 as amended by the consent order, that there are some additional or reworded policies down there I've referred to. I am not sure whether the rezoning will result in significant risk. As the natural hazard is identified, but the risk is unknown, I have applied a precautionary approach. I therefore retain my recommendations on the rezoning request. I recommend a site for Southern Ventures Property Limited, 3190, in Albert Town be partly rezoned to lower density suburban residential zone, with the rest of the site remaining as rural lifestyle with a building restriction area.
I'm of the view that the rezoning will enable an efficient and effective use of appropriately located land for low-density residential living purposes. Natural and other hazards, by which I refer to an old landfill, have been addressed and the site can be fully serviced. I consider that the rezoning is consistent with the strategic direction of the PDP and is the most appropriate way to achieve the purpose of the RMA. For all other requests, I consider that the notified PDP zones are more appropriate. I consider that these requests do not meet the relevant statutory tests and the rezoning assessment principles set out in Mr. Barr's strategic evidence. The key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and submitters who have filed evidence are whether a former riverbed site in Cadrona should be rezoned from rural to sediment, and whether a commercial precinct is appropriate over land along Soho Street in Cadrona. In addition to my comments on natural hazards above, I consider that the commercial precinct sought would undermine the Cadrona Village Character Guideline and would be inconsistent with the PDP strategic direction and the settlement zone provisions. Whether the Kingston Flyer Railway Corridor should be rezoned settlement with a commercial precinct. Submitter 3297 Kingston Lifestyle Properties Limited. The settlement zone provides for low intensity or low density residential living and only anticipates small scale commercial activities that primarily service a local convenience purpose. I consider that the railway corridor and tourist train activity does not fit well with the zone purpose and provisions, and a designation may be more appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Devlin. Can I take you first just for a point of clarification?
The building restriction area.
Yes, yep. Fronting Oban Street.
Yes.
Is the basis of your understanding that's incorrect, that it's in a significant enlargement from the ADP zone and there's no indication of any rationale for changing?
That's my understanding, yep, that it's just a straightforward error. It's always meant to be 10 metres, but when you actually measure it yourself on a map, it's more closer to 25. It had been pointed out by several submitters, and the council was aware of it too.
Actually, 10.3. Can you tell me why this particular consent was granted with a finite term? It's quite unusual for a land use consent. I've seen it done.
For the camping ground, yeah. So it was, yeah, there was sort of a couple of parts to that consent. There was all the, there was the Mrs. Woolley's general store, which you can stay there, and then there was the temporary one was for the camping component. I am not 100% sure why that part was temporary. It may have been a concession during the publicly notified hearing process for that redevelopment.
Which was quite the process.
Pardon?
Which was quite the process.
Yes, I understand, yes. So the Mrs. Woolley's is fine to stay there, the general store, and then the other, the camp, Glenorchy developments, obviously permanent buildings, but the camping ground, I think, behind Mrs. Woolley's is temporary.
So in 10.9, when you say the lapse date, you mean the consent expiring?
Yes, that's right. So it's just clarifying that, yep, the general store doesn't have to be pulled down any time.
they've given effect to it. The lapse date just refers to that camping activity.
I was thinking, I was getting confused because lapse means something quite different to expire.
Right, yes.
In an RMA context.
Yep.
Figure 8. I was trying to identify where the brown wahi tupuna lines are.
Oh, it's over the whole area, yeah.
Oh, so it's resident. So
they're just very pale, yeah.
So, but it's the whole thing?
Yes, yep.
Looking at the discussion of Bible face, I was looking at the two figures, figure 9 and 10,
yes.
And I wondered about the bit on the right-hand side, at the top right, which seems to have been added from the ODP.
The location of the BRA?
Yes, indeed.
It's like it's a lot wider.
Indeed.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's got a different shape. It's obvious.
Yes.
I'm not sure.
I'm just trying to remember which one came first.
Yeah, good point.
I think the fuzzy one, which I had uplifted from a PDF, so I couldn't make it any better than that, was from the section 32 for the Bible face plan change, and that has been interpreted, transposed, however you like, into the next one on figure 10. So figure 10 was the one that ended up in the district plan in the ODP. The section 32.
Well, I suppose my question is that
superseded.
A mistake? Is that a mistake too?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry.
Do you think you could investigate that?
Yes.
Because presumably, looking for your discussion of the submission you're responding to. So as amended to align with the settlement rural zone boundary, does that mean it should be amended at that top right as well to extend the...
I see what you're saying, yes.
That's probably not what the submitter means, but...
But it might still be their land, I'm not sure.
And even if it's not... So the upshot is... Where is the base of the face at that point?
Yes, yep.
Because if the base is actually at the zone boundary, that might be a good reason to accept the submission.
Yes, yep. And that seemed to be what it was intended for through that plan change. But yeah, as you pointed out, the maps don't match up very nicely.
The Droga Village. Do you know how far through this land exchange is? Is it beyond the beyond the point of reversal?
When I first looked at the parcels of land on the GRS, I think there was definitely a notation on it. But that's going back a few months, and it can take time for changes in property boundaries and things to be reflected in
but
the GRS.
But if there's a notation, that suggests that the formal process is well
had been initiated. Yes, I think so.
I can ask the Cadrona Village for exact
details.
Yes,
and they may have gotten further along with it since then.
Like another update, 14.19, you talk about an application being made in January 2020 to extend the lapse date.
And that was issued, yes.
So it was issued.
I might have had that in my rebuttal.
All right, that's all I need to know.
Yep. There are other consent for the land on the sort of Cadrona side of the river hasn't been issued yet.
So that's the one you're referring to in 2014-20.
Which para, sorry? Oh, 14-20, yes. Yep, so the time extension has been approved. The subdivision has not, that's the 191114. And in 1421, the 190669 has not been approved yet either. Sorry, there's three consents there. There's the land use, which has been extended, and is live for another 5 years, I think. The subdivision around the land use has not been approved.
Not determined yet, that's right, it hasn't been refused.
Yeah, right, decision hasn't been made, yes, and likewise for the comprehensive development, decision hasn't been made yet.
I got as far as paragraph 30.10 now, and I wondered about the consistency of your logic recommending that a separated commercial area in Luggett was okay, but it wasn't okay in Cadrona, where tell you that when we went on our site visit, we stood at the bottom end of Soho Street, looked back at the pub, and it's not that far.
No.
And then we walked up Soho Street to the state the highway, and it's quite close there. So, as I say, there seemed to me to be a consistency issue.
It does, and I agree. It would probably read as an extension, the difference being the Cadrona character design guideline, and it being now embedded in chapter 20, and being very firm that the commercial area would stay along the main road and not the full length of the main road but centred around the hotel, whereas that guideline or, you know, sort of specificity isn't applied to any of the other settlements. So, for example, in Kingston, the two notified precincts are quite a distance apart, yeah, with one being on the highway and one being down by the old the flyer buildings.
Gotcha.
But I've just, yeah, I agree, yes, it would, you know, it is walkable and that kind of thing, but yeah, the guideline just seemed very clear that the commercial activities stay on the main road.
Understand. Kingston O and L line. Basically saying no landscape assessment cleared by the submitter. Can you point me to a landscape assessment supporting where the line has been notified?
So my understanding is that the O&L line around Kingston is stage one and has, yeah, would have gone through the process back then, and that all that's happened with Kingston is that because it's now part of the PDP, and Sarah can jump in if I'm explaining this wrong, I guess, that because it's become a new urban area, it becomes separate from the ONL, the ONL is now around it as such. Yes, so wherever the ONL was determined around Kingston was in stage one, and I think includes pretty much all of the valley and the mountains, from what I recall from looking at Dr. Reed's evidence from a long time ago.
So the question is that long line of reasoning open to challenge that by moving from a planning outcome to a landscape outcome, you're doing exactly what the Court of Appeal said not to do in Man of War, which was first get your landscape advice and then decide your planning outcome on the basis of your landscape advice.
I don't have an answer off the top of my head, sorry.
Right. Here above the ones at 3.8, you refer to both a 2001 Wenawkee Town Plan and then a visioning report in 2016.
Yes.
In the fullness of time, you think you could give us copies of those?
I have a copy in here if you'd like it.
Not the second. As I say, the fullness of time is just fine.
Yes.
In your discussion of Cadrona Village, referring to chapter, and I wondered whether 28.3.1.6 was also directly relevant, because that says not preclude development that doesn't increase hazard risk on other properties, whereas this would seem the issue is that that's exactly what,
yes, it is.
Mr. Vaughan is saying that this will do,
yes,
or may do.
Yep, I agree with that. And I've referred to downstream effects but there may be upstream effects too, from my understanding from Mr. Bond.
I wonder if you were asking the right question. Say, it does not mean that it must also provide for additional commercial or retail development. Is necessity the question, or is it appropriateness?
Yes, I mean, for a rezoning assessment, it should be appropriateness, and I guess I'm just sort of commenting on my view that you could create a new pedestrian focused area, but yeah, I don't see that therefore you must move on and have a new zone to provide for it. It could occur under the activities that are enabled by the VAS seed over that area.
Thank you very much, Ms. Devlin. That's all I have. Commissioner Dawson.
Just a couple of questions, please. The first one relates, they all relate to your rebuttal.
Yes.
If you look at the map, Appendix B1, which is the one Benmore Place in Glenorchy.
Yes.
Just having been to the site, and I wonder, is the area that you recommend being, or are you recommending the area that could be a commercial precinct, I think it's like on one Redmore Place, is that smaller than the area that was requested in the Blackthorn submission? I mean,
yes.
It does seem very small.
It
in terms of its depth, I'm talking about its depth.
Yes, yeah. In depth, it probably is smaller in depth, and it was smaller in width as well, because they had drawn their boundary right out to the opposite road is.
I mean, I can understand the logic for the width of it down Mull Street. It's just my question really is, why not a little deeper?
Yes.
Not necessarily as deep as the ones on the other side of Mull Street, but certainly deep enough to be a series of regular section sizes other ones on that further up and on that side of Mull Street.
I agree, it could be wide,
it
deeper.
It's going to restrict the usability of those of that lot. Yeah. All right, thank you.
That's a good point. Thank you.
And the second one is about Mrs. Woolley's, and I think this is possibly just a misunderstanding on my part when we were there on the ground. But did the submitter ask to extend the commercial precinct across both the Mrs. Woolley's building site and the front side of the camping ground that's next door to it? Because that's what you've done.
I think they have. I want to say yes, because I based this map on their submitter evidence, and I didn't use their submitter evidence just because the colours and things weren't sort of dark, you know, obvious enough.
That's right.
But I have tried to just follow their lines.
I mean, because everyone talks about Mrs. Woolley's, but I guess there's the land that might be owned by Mrs. Woolley's, and then there's the shop building that's Mrs. Woolley's, and what I'm not sure is whether you're intending that the front half of the camping ground, which is on the corner of Cole Street and over, not the Camp Glenorchy, but the one that's part of Mrs. Woolley, which is a currently basically vacant land, you're intending that that also be part of a new commercial precinct?
Yes. Yep. If that, if I've interpreted their map correctly, because I agreed with them.
But also, I'm asking you, is that your opinion that it should be?
Yes, because I've very much relied on their economic evidence, which I felt was reasonably compelling, and the restriction on GFA that went with it. So it didn't seem to be too much.
So it comes with a restriction on GFA, no matter what the area
is
covered.
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
Yep. So I think they would have, was it just under 1,000 square metres of
which may be
total,
more than what's there already.
With the general store and back of house things.
And didn't they also ask for a visitor accommodation subzone over the camping ground to the rear of those two
sites? They did.
And
yes.
I recommended
that for approval in my 42A.
So you'd already done that, covered it off in your 42A, and didn't need to repeat that again.
Repeat it. Yes.
Okay, that's fine. And the other thing, this is a bit like along the lines of my discussion with Mr. Barr. Could I turn you to the wording of your rules for the Albert Town Templeton Street site, 7.5
I was reading those while you were questioning Mr. Barr.
Yeah, so, well, have you got anything you'd like to change?
Honestly, I'm open to suggestions because I've just uplifted this from the submitter evidence.
Well, I only have two comments. One is that these are standards that apply to residential units. And B and D sort of don't really apply to residential units.
Mm.
They apply to the works.
The works. Mm.
And so it would be impossible to apply B and D on a long-term basis as standards on a residential unit. So you need to find some other way of dealing with, if those are things you want to cover off, the long-term protection of these fill works, it needs to probably be done at the subdivision stage and then become conditions on an ongoing basis through a consent order or something on the subdivision, or else find some other way of dealing with it.
Yes,
because otherwise these houses are going to have conditions on them. Well, no, they can't because they're permitted.
Well, they are once these works are done.
That's right. So if the works are done, the houses are permitted, and so the long-term protection of those works can't really be achieved through the people in the houses.
So anyway,
that's for you to think about, and presumably the Southern Ventures people.
Yeah.
And the second thing.
Southern Ventures didn't really think this needed to go in there because they were of the view it would get subdivided first. And
yes, and this is like a sort of backstop in case some houses come.
It's just a backstop and may not even be needed, but it was just the height of the fill.
So, I mean, you have to think about whether B and D are needed at all.
Yes.
And if so, how would they be implemented?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is a bit more minor, in that you say no residential unit shall be constructed on the Templeton Street site. And I'm thinking, well, there are other sets, properties on Templeton Street. And then you go on, until such time as fill works are constructed in accordance with the plan contained in Appendix 7.7. So 7.7 is linked to the fill works, but not to the words residential units on the Templeton Street site. So you probably just need to say no residential units shall be constructed on the Templeton Street site shown in Appendix 7.7 until such time as the fill works shown on that plan are completed.
Yes, I agree.
So that it's very clear that the other people on Templeton Street aren't going to get lumbered with this.
Yes.
That comes up in C as well.
Yes, I see what you mean.
That's all from me.
Mr. Hill.
Thank you.
Mr. McLeod. No, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Devlin. And
thank
you also for sitting patiently.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Some time. Now for ballots.
The ballots. We're making good progress, I think. So first of all, Miss Edgley. So Miss Edgley's topic is the open space and recreation variation. She has filed her section 42A in one statement of rebuttal, and her summary was in the package I handed up this morning. So late last week, a consent order was issued by the Environment Court, which is relevant to this topic. We do have copies now to hand up. But I'll leave Ms. Edgley to explain.
Does this topic cover that tricky site down at the wharves? It does, doesn't it?
It relates to it,
yes. So I wonder if we could get something up on the... Because it's sort of, I think, what would be the best plan for you to put up there so that you can point everything out to us? What about figure 2 in your 42A report, or...
There's an aerial somewhere.
So there's figure 1 and figure 2 in Ms. Edgley's.
Yes, they're probably the best.
Thank you.
Yeah, figure 1 of the aerial.
But also, but I'm here.
But we can see what's under it.
But then I'd also like the zoning one at some stage so we can sort of.
Cool. Good afternoon. I've assessed and made recommendations on the submissions on the variation to the open space and related chapters 38, 36 and 29, and on rezoning requests relating to land adjacent to Queenstown Bay. Stage 2 of the district plan review introduced an open space zoning regime to council-administered reserves. This replaced the operative district plan regime, where reserves were often zoned rural or the same zoning as the adjoining land. The open space variation in Stage 3 seeks to resolve unintended consequences arising from the open space zoning undertaken in Stage 2. These include rezoning council-administered reserve land previously missed and varying the rules relating to land adjoining town centre zones to ensure that these areas do not unduly restrict activities undertaken in the adjoining zones. Having considered the submissions and evidence, I consider that my recommended amendments to the text of Chapters 38, Open Space and Recreation, and 36, Noise, will provide the following benefits in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. Recognition that the effects of greater encroachment by outdoor commercial dining into public spaces can be anticipated, and increase opportunities for more flexible and improved design of these facilities through a restricted discretionary consent approach, and providing greater consistency with the town centre zone noise limits by including the LAF maximum while protecting reserves for public use. The key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and the submitters are whether an adjoining open space zoning is the most appropriate, whether an open space zoning is the most appropriate for the land adjoining Queenstown Bay, whether there should be a requirement to obtain resource consent for new areas of commercial outdoor dining in those areas adjoining the active frontage area of Queenstown Bay, and whether specific policy support is required in Chapter 38 for water-based activities and related commercial activities in Queenstown Bay. The retention of an open space zoning for the land adjoining Queenstown Bay will ensure consistent treatment of council-administered reserve land across the district, and, with the amendments proposed by the variation, will provide for appropriate recreation-related activities that support the vitality of the adjacent Queenstown Town Centre zone while maintaining the purpose of the land for public use as part of the public realm. The introduction of a rule relating to commercial outdoor dining in the areas adjoining the active frontage area of Queenstown Bay is necessary to avoid the application of the default activity status of non-complying for non-listed activities. A restricted discretionary activity status will recognise the role outdoor dining plays in achieving an active waterfront interface while retaining the ability to assess the effects on the reserve. The existing objectives and policies of the open space chapter, when read as a whole, seek to maintain and protect the recreation and amenity values of the open space zoned land for the benefit of the public. They do, however, also provide for activities, including commercial and commercial recreation activities, where these have a functional need to locate within the open space zone, or can demonstrate that they will maintain the values of these zones. Water-based activities in Queenstown Bay would fall to be assessed under these provisions where they occurred on open space zoned land. In summary, the reserve land adjoining town centre zones typically have a high public use function, and in my opinion, the level of oversight that I have recommended is appropriate to maintain the balance between retaining the reserved land for the benefit of the public and ensuring the vibrancy of the town centre zones.
Thank you, Ms. Eppley. I think the starting point might be, I noted your description of the conditional basis of Queenstown Wharf's submission in your paragraph 3.1. In the event the draft consent order be approved, so they see various rules, various provisions from the variation only be approved if the consent order is approved, but if it's not approved, they see all manner of other things. The question is, does the consent order approve in the manner anticipated or not? And then can you tell us what the consent order does do?
So the consent order has made some changes, including numbering and format changes.
I don't imagine that's a problem at this minute.
Changes to the activity status, and included some new rules. Key to the current issues in relation to the variation is the inclusion of a new restricted discretionary rule for buildings on wharves and jetties, where these buildings meet specific criteria relating to size, height, and number per wharf, which is the new 12.4.8 rule in the consent order. 12.4.8.
Where are the specific criteria?
They are listed in the rule itself.
Oh, immediately under the heading.
Immediately under the heading, yeah. So they have to be...
That's just in the heading.
Yes. So they must have a functional need associated with surface of water activities. They have to be less than 15 square metres in area and no more than 3 metres in height above the floor level of the jetty or wharf on which they're located. And there can be no more than one per jetty or wharf.
Can I assume that the impact on the pedestrian flow also includes disability access?
I would have thought so, yes. That would be my understanding. The other key area of difference from the decisions version is that the consent order version also provides for wharves and jetties within the active frontage area of the Queenstown Bay as a restricted discretionary activity. Previously, these were discretionary.
So they would move from full discretion
to restricted.
To RDA.
Within the area of the active frontage area.
What is the active frontage area?
The active frontage area is the area around from the town pier through to St. Omer's Wharf.
Northern side.
Yes, so yeah. The area is sort of commonly known as Earnslaw Park, so it goes all the way on that picture. It does extend all the way to the edge of the red, the far western point of the red line, all the way back around to the town pier, which is the main pier that KJET
opposite the statue that's about to be pulled
down.
Opposite the
sheep. The re-statue, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, sheep, not approved.
Okay, and
that is rule 12.4.7 in the new consent order, yes.
And
have you got the answer to your question?
I've got the answer to the first one, I think.
Has it resolved the issues that the submitter was?
My understanding is that this was a consent order by consent, so that all the parties agreed to it.
So in Queenstown Walsh was a party, so the court has made the order in the terms sought.
That's my understanding, yes.
So the alternative doesn't kick in.
Point out things to us. It's not so much a matter of questioning your evidence. I just want to make sure that in this area of this, that we are all very clear what's what.
So what is owned, what and who, what are the alternatives?
I sort of go through what I saw as a logical progression. So, what did the notified change show? What has QWL requested? What have you recommended? Are there any gaps?
Can we stop there?
that's probably enough to be going on with.
Okay, yeah. So, starting from notified.
Is that plan better or the next one? If you can just take a snapshot of that in your brain and then move to the other.
Figure 2,
it's on the couple of pages. This is the
stage two.
Yes. What's the blue?
The blue is the extent of the property parcel. In this case,
sorry. It's bluey green.
Yes, so
you
can see.
Teal.
Teal, okay. And the blue, but I mean, what's the sea? What's the blue?
Water.
No, it can't possibly. You don't colour water. What is the actual blue colour, not the teal colour? What is that?
This? Yeah. So that's the lake. And so my understanding is that in this period,
yeah, that's what I thought. Yes, that's what I thought.
Yeah. So it is,
it's not rural. It's not as shown as blue. In this area, within that orange line.
Yes, that's my understanding.
Yes. Yes.
While we normally
wouldn't
see this
as a rural
zone,
there is
a rural
zone
that's
stated
otherwise.
Yes.
And if there is a water front subzone,
onto the system line. That is really tricky to work out. But yes, because that orange line is the waterfront subzone, it means it must be over the Queenstown Town Centre zone, because that's the only place that the waterfront subzone applies in the provisions.
And as well as a small portion of the eastern region.
Okay, all right, but the main zone that it applies in. So you have to assume that in this location, because it's got a subzone, it must have the parent zone.
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be possible.
It wouldn't work otherwise. Yeah. Okay. Queenstown Town Centre. Because that's what the Queenstown something 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 subzone is a subzone of.
Right. So which is the bit that's the Council of Ministers that has the reserve? That's the bit of the
who owns the parcel that's zoned informal recreation but outside the reserve? But it'll be someone like Lynn's. Yeah, Lynn's. Yeah, but it's not Queenstown Wharfs.
I'm not sure about that. It's probably better.
Okay. But not necessarily the land that it sits on. But anyway, we'll ask them that. Yeah. It's more likely to be Lynn's. Okay. All right.
The wharf would be, by the very definition of being a wharf, would be under the water, which would be Lynn's.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so that's the stage two. So what's been notified in this variation?
Captured for posterity.
My recommendation would have been that it followed the extent of the zone, which in this area I believe follows the shoreline as opposed to the property boundary.
So
say that again. So the variation follows the teal line.
Yes.
With the
subzone boundary.
Bound. So it's pulled from out at the street.
Yes.
Back to what people thought was the shoreline and the edge of the zone, but actually ended up being slightly in the middle of it.
That's right, yes.
So not quite.
And there's
no scope to fix that up?
I don't believe so, no. The submissions that we've had in relation to this area were to retain it, the waterfront subzone, so I don't believe that there is scope to push it further back.
But it can't actually be
boundary.
Applied over the informal recreation zone anyway.
Well, that's the issue that the variation is seeking to resolve, that we have a subzone from a different zone applying on an open space zone.
One of the issues, and correct me if I'm wrong, is when you potentially construct a new wharf,
and try and connect it to the land parcel. So you construct the wharf and you get the boat and the lens, but then what does it connect to?
Going across multiple zones.
Mm. So what
the
is
the same structure?
Mm. Well, that's sort of going to happen anyway, isn't it?
Well,
because it's always going to hop onto the land at one end of it.
But what?
So what has Queenstown Wharf Limited requested?
So in their submission, they requested the retention of the waterfront subzone over the land, and the deletion of the informal recreation zone. And in their evidence, this was expanded upon as requesting a rezoning to town centre zone.
So they requested deletion of the informal recreation zone, but didn't say what?
Not in the submission. And in my section 42A report, I recommended that that be rejected because they were, for all intents and purposes, requesting the land to not have a zone.
Yes.
Because the primary zone is the informal recreation zone. And because of the timing of stage two with stage one, this land was never officially zoned to Queenstown Town Centre Zone. It was notified as that in stage one, but it was then overtaken by the stage two notification.
Mm-hmm. Was the stage one notification actually withdrawn? You said it was overtaken.
I might have to double check the terminology. When the stage one decisions were notified, this land was shown as blank.
So I think that
would be withdrawn. Have any zoning under
stage
one.
And by then the stage two had been notified?
Yes, it was notified about 3 or 4 months, I think, for the decisions.
Because that's what happened with the Hawea camping ground. It was the same issue. Like it was notified and then pulled.
And then was re-notified.
And then re-notified in stage two.
Yeah. But so does Queenstown Wharfs Limited, we can ask them this, implying that because they've asked for the retention of the waterfront subzone, that automatically gives them a sort of in to ask for the town centre zone as well? Or do they not go that far?
I would probably need to double check their evidence.
We can ask them that.
Yeah.
But your opinion is that there's no scope to apply the town centre zone over this land. That's not what this variation is about. This variation is just about moving the subzone boundary, not about changing the underlying zone.
So because the subzone does apply, I guess there could be I might need to have a think about that.
Questions like we've had two zonings on it all the time.
Well, I guess because it does have the subzone on it, I guess there possibly could be an argument to some extent that those rules could apply, and that's the reason that the variation has been made to resolve any confusion around that.
But essentially it's the same logic. It says, well, the subzone is there, therefore it must be
town centre zone.
Therefore it must be town centre zone.
Even though it's shown on the maps as a formal recreation zone.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I understand that's what they're trying. But they're now saying, no, put it all back and take off the informal recreation and make this town centre zone.
That was my understanding from the evidence.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So in the submission it said delete informal recreation zone, but the evidence, when I read it, seemed to suggest the reinstatement of the stage one notified town centre zone.
Yes.
With the
subzone as well.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's great, thank you.
So the specific spaces zone, which are now applies to which?
The recommended rezoning would be to the land currently
in orange.
And it's probably figure one, sorry. Yeah. it would be that area of land there. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which is
so it's the informal, the area of informal recreation. Yeah.
The bit that did, the bit of the informal recreation zone that did have the ovals, the subzone over it.
Yes.
Previously.
Yes.
Previously, and now does for a wee bit still.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now that, thank you so much for that. I think that's clear what, as clear as it can get to deal with what was a complex issue. Thank you. And we now know what your recommendation is, and you've given us a bit of an overview of Queenstown Wharves, but they can tell us about that when they come as well. So that's all from me. Thank you.
I only had one additional question, and 3.2 of your rebuttal evidence saying the reasoning for complementary PDP zoning approach to the Reserves Act was set out in Council Evidence for Stream 15 and ultimately accepted by the panel. What was that reasoning in 30 seconds or less? I suppose that's the one you were on. You could tell me that.
Sorry, I wasn't listening.
It's a problem I have all the time.
No, I'm sorry, I was still writing the notes from...
No worry.
So...
Rebuttal 3.2.
I'm quite aware that I wrote up the decision or decision and provisions.
So what was the reasoning that you were referring to?
So the management of reserves through the Resource Management Act, they require a zoning of some form, and you know whether that's an adjoining zoning or, as has been decided through the Stage 2 decisions, a more specialised zoning to better integrate the PDP rules and objectives and policies with the underlying reserve management, Reserve Act management, process, where the focus is more on the use of the land for the public good.
Was the Stage 2 decision around the different purposes of the Reserves Act and the Resource Management Act and the need
to align those?
Well, no, to make sure that the zoning covered a wider suite of issues and effects,
yes,
than rather than just relying on the Reserves Act itself.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, sorry, I didn't explain that very well. So the open space zones are intended to be more reflective of the Reserve Act purpose in terms of more targeted objectives, policies and rules to those public realm purposes of the Reserves Act, as opposed to the operative district plan regime, where you could have had a rural zoning or a town centre zoning that didn't give you the ability to consider those matters that are relevant to the reserves, so
yeah,
to try and avoid that.
In an extreme case, you could have had an industrial zone.
Yes, yes. But and then be relying on the designation and the Reserves Act processes to,
yes,
deal with everything.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only question I have. Any more for any more? Negative?
No.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the helpful exposition on the map. I think it is definitely worth to be needed.
Miss Russell. And her evidence is about the Wanaka medium density residential zone variation. And you just have one brief, I think, just 42 hours. Plus a summary, of course.
Summary, please, and we'll go from there.
I prepared the Section 42A report on the notified medium density residential zone in Wanaka, two sites immediately adjacent to the Wanaka Town Center, currently being used as existing visitor accommodation businesses, are rezoned from lower density suburban residential to medium density residential. The purpose of this notification in Stage 3 was to correct an error in the zoning of these two sites that occurred through Stage 1. One submitter, C&J Properties, opposed the variation, seeking that the LDSR zoning be retained across the sites. No evidence has been filed by the submitter. It is my view that the medium density residential zone is the most efficient means to achieve the strategic direction and urban form priorities in the PDP, including by higher site yields in proximity to the town center, and will avoid the incidental ad hoc zoning sought by the submitter. In the event that the primary relief was rejected, the submitter seeks that the visitor accommodation subzone be applied to its land. The submitter's property was zoned MDR in stage one of the PDP and is immediately east of one of the notified MDR sites. Submitter's land was not notified in stage three of the PDP. In addition, the VA subzone is not a matter that is reviewed in stage three, and therefore I consider it to be out of this relief to be out of scope. Thank you.
Ms. Russell, I understand exactly what you're saying. Thank you. Any questions?
No, just to confirm, both the sites are already developed for established visitor accommodation.
Yeah, the sites we seek to vary are existing historical visitor accommodation that are on a commercial scale.
And all the surrounding sites in that the block or blocks that they're in are also all zoned medium density residential.
Correct.
So these are just little anomalies within a whole block of a different zoning, which this variation changes them to match their neighbours.
Absolutely. So it's essentially bringing it up to what the rest of the neighbourhood reflects, which is MDR, is that adjacent to the Wanaka Central City.
All right. No, thank you very much.
I just thought, having said I had nothing, I'd always the commissioners. Question is raised and not issued one. Although the neighbouring sites are zoned MDR, are they actually developed to that intensity?
Not yet, no. In general, in my view. But they will over time. That's the expectation. It's a fairly recent upzoning.
And it was a specific upzoning in the last stage one plan, consistent with the sort of new policies of.
Absolutely, yeah. It's sort of aligned with the strategic direction and urban form priorities that the PDP is setting.
It's fairly close to the town centre.
Immediately adjacent, yeah.
All good. Thank you very much, Ms. Russell.
Thank you.
Thank you. That it definitely is it.
Is that current record?
Moving along.
Okay, Ms. Simpson. Again, for the panel's reference, just one statement, Section 42A. No corrections.
Have you confessed about your Freudian slip to Ms. Simpson, Ms. Scott?
Oh, yeah. She quite liked it, I think.
My autocorrect.
Mm.
In my Section 42A report, I provided recommendations on the submissions and further submissions received on the firefighting variation to chapters 21, 22, 23, 24 and 38, notified as part of stage 3. No evidence was filed by submitters in relation to this variation. The purpose of this variation is to standardise the approach to managing risk from fire to habitable buildings in rural areas with no or insufficient water supply. In my view, this will be the most efficient means for achieving the strategic direction of the plan and will provide clarity and consistency across all the rural chapters which the 17 submission points predominantly seek. In terms of changes to the notified variation, I accept in part the submission from Waterfall Park Limited 3063 seeking to vary the requirement to exclude potable water in the maintained water supply for firefighting purposes, but consider that the Code of Practice, which is a national standard for New Zealand Fire Service, should be complied with. I accept in part the submission from Fire and Emergency New Zealand 3288 supporting both the inclusion of a new policy in Chapter 23 and requesting amendments to rules across a number of chapters. But I reject the inclusion of a new provision regarding rules for non-residential habitable buildings across chapters 21 to 24. Wayfair Group Limited's 3343 submission sought to allow for more discretion for non-conformance. In my report, I recommend that this relief be rejected because the notified provisions already provide the discretion sought and the revised wording is neither more effective nor efficient. The evidence filed by Mr. Farrell for Wayfair Group does not address this submission point.
Thank you, Ms. Simpson. Can I ask you a question about paragraph 4.7 first? And that is, what has the council historically required in terms of water storage volumes?
Well, across the existing chapters differ at the moment between 20,000 and then 45,000, and the Gibson Valley chapter doesn't actually have anything in there. But the engineering resource management engineering team have had a memorandum of kind of understanding around the 45,000 litres.
Do we know why Gibson doesn't have any standard, given that it certainly has residences?
Yes, I don't actually know that.
Sounds like an error to me. Yeah. go to Can you tell me what a maintained water supply is? What does the word maintained add? What does it mean, even?
Right. My understanding of a maintained water supply is that it's constantly there. So you can get some water supplies which will empty and fill up over time and fill quite slowly. So you might end up with an empty tank for part of the time, but in a maintained one should stay pretty much full.
Would the word continuous be rather clearer?
I'm not sure really. I see continuous as flowing, so.
Yeah, well, as I say, maintained doesn't quite do it for me. Like, I was thinking, does that mean you have to get out and regularly check there are no cracks and the valves are working and.
The maintenance is done. So
the maintenance is done. Like I guess that was what was intended.
It means the water supply shall be maintained at all times.
Yes. Yeah. A water supply shall be maintained at all times.
Of at least.
We'll do it. Okay. But the answer is it's supposed to mean there all the time.
Yes.
And relation to habitable buildings, what do you define as a habitable building? Is a garden shed a habitable building?
Or a glamping tent?
Or a glamping tent?
A glamping tent. I know in terms of this, a habitable building is supposed to mean a residential dwelling or unit. It's not supposed to include sheds, which people aren't kind of habitually living in all the time.
So it is.
Is there a definition? No definition.
No.
The Building Act says buildings used for occupation. Is that what's intended?
Yes.
Identifies buildings used for occupation as a class of building.
But you don't use that. You don't use that word in the rules, do you? Habitable building in the. Maybe you do. I'm only looking at your revision.
I think it is.
Sorry, I'm only looking at the revision. It's not that.
Just going to 6.1, when FENS submitted on the chapters, it was their recommendation to include
word. That's what they've
habitable.
Submitted.
Yeah.
And you've said. That's not really a term that's used in the plan. Mm.
So maybe I should be asking them what they mean, rather than asking you to make sense of their submission.
can I just follow up, because I had a question. From what I understand of what they're actually wanting this standard to be applied to non-habitable or non-residential buildings. But you're saying, well, actually, they, in the zones referred to by FENS, these are all either controlled, restricted, discretionary, non-complying, and where it's controlled or restricted, discretionary, there's adequate matters of discretion to cover the matter. So
yes.
There's no need to add in a standard when it can easily be covered by through the consent process.
That's correct, yes.
So we don't need to worry whether they're habitable or not. They get caught up with all the other activity statuses and definitions.
They do, yes.
Right.
One quick one, which an ex-councillor would not forgive me if I didn't ask the question, is if under the ODD you satisfied the maintained water supply at 25,000 litres, which is certain tanks are, and we're now requesting 45,000 litres, does that mean that you'd have to buy a second tank?
Yes, that's correct. I think the largest tank is around 30,000 litres or 35,000 litres, so you will need two tanks.
But
well,
if you're already there, you'd have existing rights?
Yes, and this is for new buildings.
Yeah, for new.
So this is simply for new buildings?
Yes.
That can't
so
really
anyone that has 20,000 litres, burns down, that would be
same, just to replace it.
Sweet. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Simpson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have Mr. Matthew for second show. This is to do with the Frankton Road height control mapping variation. He has just filed a 642A and a brief summary.
Welcome back, Mr. Bailey.
The variation addressed a mapping error identified in stage 1 of the district plan review whereby an area of land to the south side of Franklin Road side, was erroneously included within a mapping annotation. Land within the mapping annotation is subject to specific rules that limit the maximum permitted height of buildings. The effect of this error is that these rules of the high density residential zone erroneously apply to the land. My evidence assessed and makes recommendations on the Fred van Badenburg submission, which opposes the variation. I've grouped my analysis of this into four main topics, three of which are summarized below. Overall, my recommendation is that the panel should remove the mapping annotation as notified. Topic 1, rejecting the mapping variation. Should the mapping variation be rejected, then the area identified would remain subject to the above rules. In many cases, development would then effectively not be permitted, and it would require a discretionary activity resource consent in order to develop the land in accordance with the HCR zone purpose. This is not the intention of these rules, and it would, in my view, unduly restrict development. On the contrary, removal would allow for the application of the general HCR height rules and would achieve the most appropriate outcome for the efficient and effective management of development of the Franklin Roadside zoned HCR. Topic 2, amending the wording of the rules. In combination with the relief sought above, the submitter also seeks that the rules be amended to allow for some building elements to exceed the height of the Franklin Road carriageway centre line. In my view, there is no scope to amend these rules and as they apply to the land zoned HCR other than within the Franklin Road site, nor to amend any HCR provisions generally. Nevertheless, in my view, when considering the proposed amended rules, as they would apply to the subject land only, they would still unduly restrict development on the subject land. It would only allow one story in height for many sites and none for others, and introduce unnecessary complexity. Topic 3, extend the removal of the mapping annotation to the submitter's land. As alternative relief, Mr. Brandenburg's submission seeks that the variation be amended so that the mapping annotation is removed from his land. The submitter states that there are no clear planning reasons for the application of different height rules to neighbouring properties within the HCR. In my evidence, I outline the planning reasons why the mapping annotation should apply to the submitter's land and why the different height rules should apply to the specified properties within the HCR. I also do not consider the application of different height rules to neighbouring properties within the HCR would have adverse amenity effects between neighbouring sites not anticipated by the HCR zone. Overall, I consider that Mr. Rambanaman's land does not have any distinguishing features that set it apart from the rest of the land covered by the mapping annotation, with the exception of the Franklin Road site, and I am not persuaded that it warrants special treatment.
Matthew, when we took our site visit, we parked up the road, I'm not sure what it's called, on the opposite side of the Franklin Road, driving towards Franklin. And we walked down the road, and we started looking at the houses that are the subject of this height rule at the present, mm-hmm. and the variation, and you recommend be relieved of that obligation, and it's obvious why the variation has been promulgated, because some of them are at grade, some of them are half a story below the road carriage. The rule makes no sense. It basically would sterilise the land. Then we got to a little lane, which I see is not on the map. And this is the last site before you get to the edge into Mr. Van Brandenburg's property. And at the Frankton end of that site, yes, it's obvious that the distance from the property to the road is not sufficient, that or that the that the height limit stay out of the road carriageway would be a significant restriction. But the road rises and the land drops. So by the time you get to Mr. Van Brandenburg's boundary, the property is a long way below you. And so we walked back and thought, well, we can understand why when it wasn't mapped, it would have gone to a cadastral boundary. But is there a case for that height limit to stop at some point up that property? We thought the tennis court was too far. We started measuring it by stumps that are on the ground looking down. Now, have you thought about the possibility that part of that site might be the subject of the height limit, where there is a significant drop from the road to the base and part not? That's the punchline. Because that, as I say, that's the impression we gain just from walking up the road and when walking back.
Yeah. I think my thinking around that was mostly whether where do you achieve a balance between applying the rule that you can still build a 7 meter high building and still achieve the purpose of the rule, which is to maintain the views from the road. And if you, in my thinking around it, is if you can't build a building that's 7 meter high without breaching that specific rule, then it becomes undue restricting on the site. So I think that position of the line, I think it only really becomes possible to build those buildings on the Van Brandenburg site. But as soon as you come closer to the tennis courts, any 7 meter high building is starting to pop off the road.
Well, that's our point. But
yeah,
that at the far end, there's a lot more than 7 meters.
Mm.
We're at the Queenstown end, there's a lot more than 7 meters. At the tennis court end, there's a lot less. And at some intermediate point, you're going to you cross a threshold, and so the question is: have you considered pulling the line some way up that property? Not all the way, because that I understand your logic at the Frankton end of that last property, and some of the way.
I thought the line was more or less in the right place.
Have you been on site and thought exactly about this? Where would it happen?
Yeah, yes. It's probably not exactly the right spot, but I thought it was more or less. But it doesn't really make sense to me to apply different height rules to the same site. It makes the application of the rule really problematic.
So it could be just a little bit into that site,
but
not far enough to make it worthwhile having two height limits on the same site.
Exactly, and if you look at the submitter's site, most of it is already excavated to put a building in there. There's already, the road there is basically 2 to 4 meters built up already, so that already provides a bit of a buffer to get a building in there. Compared to the neighbouring side where we're proposing the rule shouldn't apply, the road is basically almost at the level of the land for most of it. Any 7 metre high building there would trigger it on this side of the cadash or the subject, the land, basically.
So your response to our question is that, yes, there is a point, but it's not far enough in that it would make sense make that distinction.
Yeah. I think the line
in terms of planned administration.
Exactly, yeah. The line is more or less where that big tree is, which is more or less where the road's starting to get built up by retaining walls. So it's kind of more or less in the right location, and I think it's a bit problematic to try and just move it by a couple of metres to. And the difference between the two sites, there's already other Balkan location rules that protects the amenity between the two sides.
I understand.
And setbacks and things.
Any other questions, Mr. Matthew?
I'm just wondering what was on the site of the tennis court before it was cleared. Was that a hotel?
There was like a motel type. It was more lower on the property.
That's talk in the side. No, I'm getting the questions.
Mr.
Gordon?
No, that's exactly.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bevan.
Right, lucky last. Ms. Flory.
A position of considerable responsibility holding the honour of the team.
Maybe
we should adjourn for a cup of tea then.
I think now is actually the point.
I do have some housekeeping, so they can ask me those questions.
Ms. Flory, you have a summary. Would you like to read it? I'm sorry.
Sorry.
It's been a long week.
Ms. Flory does have two Section 42As. So she has her Section 42A on the Galea variation and rebuttal evidence. And she also has prepared another Section 42A. It's called Stage 3 and 3B General Submissions. It's essentially the submissions that we couldn't allocate to a particular topic.
Yep. Okay. Good afternoon. My evidence assesses and makes recommendations on the QAC and Wayfair submission, which seeks amendments to the notified provisions to manage effects of glare on aircraft operations and navigational safety, respectively. In relation to Queenstown Airport submission 3316, in response to the evidence of Melissa Brooks for QAC, I consider the notified provisions are appropriate in managing the effects of glare. The key matters of disagreement between QAC and myself are whether the effects of glare on aircraft operations are more appropriately included in a QAC designation or as a matter of discretion within relevant zone chapters, and whether Figure 2 from the QAC airport designation is more appropriate in showing the extent of area in which glare creates adverse effects on the safety of aircraft operations, or whether further analysis needs to be provided by QAC. Having considered the submission and further evidence of QAC, my recommendations are that the designation process is a more appropriate method of addressing QAC's concerns rather than an amendment to the notified matters of discretion. A change to the designation would need to happen outside the plan review process. And if the panel was to prefer the option of addressing the issue through a matter of discretion in relevant zone chapters, that further analysis needs to be provided by QAC, which identifies specific extents in which lights, which could create potential hazards and create confusion to aircraft operations. In my view, going through the designation process will allow the effects to be managed more effectively, will provide certainty in plan implementation, consistency in how designation-related issues are managed within the plan, and will provide landowners more certainty for resource consent applications. I acknowledge that the effects of glare do affect the safety of aircraft operations. However, I maintain that the most efficient, effective, and appropriate method is through the designations process rather than the amendment to the planning provisions. In relation to Wayfair Group Limited submission 3343, in response to the evidence of Ben Farrell for Wayfair, I consider that the notified provisions are more appropriate in managing the effects of glare. I do not have sufficient evidence to recommend the relief sought by the submitter. The key outstanding matter of disagreement is whether the provision recommended is appropriate within all the zones relevant to the variation. I also have the following concerns with the relief sought. There are potential rule drafting issues. The relief sought will create uncertainty for resource consent applications in zones affected by this variation. And the relief sought creates ambiguity in the resource consenting process for applications in zones located adjacent to water bodies.
Thank you, Ms. Flory. Can I ask you first about your general evidence? The Ministry of Education wanting to amend definitions.
Yes.
Could we, in fact, do we have scope to amend definitions that apply to provisions that are not in Stage 3?
My response to that submission is that we will do an overall variation to include everything as part of the national planning standards, so it will be more effective to do it later on.
I suppose my question is, even if we disagreed with that, do we have the ability to, do we have the jurisdiction to grant the submission other than as it relates to the provisions that are before us?
I'm not too sure.
I can help out there. So, no, you don't. There's of course scope to amend any definitions that have been notified in this stage. There is a real risk with changing a definition in this stage that applies to a whole bunch of stage one and two chapters, as it could and likely would change the regulatory effect of those provisions.
Yes, I thought the overall process that Ms. Gloria is talking about will be quite a mission for precisely that reason.
Like another whole review.
Ms. Dawson and I had that experience in Christchurch where there were changes reasonably late in the process to definitions, and essentially the council had to go through and check every single rule to see if a change to a definition or change to the entire definitions chapter changed the regulatory effect of rules already decided on. Huge task.
I'm sure Ian wouldn't mind.
Sorry?
I'm sure Ian wouldn't mind going back and reviewing the entire flight.
I think the short answer is there's no scope.
Thank you. No scope.
Don't do it.
The second question relates to Transpower's terminology. They want to change pylons to transmission line support structures. Is this just terminology, or are there actually support structures that are not pylons on that line as it comes through the district? As it comes through the district, as a matter of fact, do you know the answer to that?
I'm not off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Sorry, is the question, are there any Transpower pylons in this district?
There are certainly pylons. There's a line coming into Frankton. But the question is, are there support structures that are not pylons?
All right.
Which is another way of asking, is the difference in terminology material? Or is it just terminology that Transpower have a manual and they like to call things what they call things?
I think so. I have a recollection of Transpower wanting to change some terminology because they didn't have certain what they describe as a certain type of infrastructure in this district. But my recollection is too fuzzy to really assist
you. Okay. Sometimes they have quite considerable poles.
Yeah.
But it's the same.
But that, which you may not call a pylon.
Doesn't it fall into the same category as horseless carriage becomes vehicle?
Yeah.
Mm. Well, that's
what I wanted
to know. This is only an annotation on the maps, isn't it? It doesn't go into the rest of the plan.
Yeah, from my understanding.
It's what you're calling it.
Yeah, it's just
all right.
What you call things on the map.
And I wondered about your logic and your answer to QAC. You're saying, well, that you'd need to consider effects of lightning and glare on aircraft operations in all zones, which is a fair point.
Mm-hmm.
But the
consider park and ride provisions, and there aren't many of those too. So I wondered about the consistency of your logic. So the transport network includes park and ride. As far as I'm aware, that's located in one corner of Frankton Flats. But every rule that refers as a matter of discretion or control to the transport network requires you to consider park and ride. So is it really that hard to consider potential effects on aircraft operation? A one line saying there aren't any. So it's a consistency issue. What do you think?
I guess going back to the consistency, the other effects that is managed by the designation, such as objects protruding to the sky, for example, in the figure one and figure two diagrams, that relates to airport as well, and that's included within the designations chapter. So I guess my logic behind that is if the effects of objects protruding to the sky is managed through the designations chapter, shouldn't the glare effects in relation to aircraft operations also be included in the designations chapter?
I mean, I guess there are planes that fly all over the district, but you wouldn't want everybody having to think about effects on them all over the district, would you?
And
it could be a bit.
Well, and how you actually do it. We might ask for his book there.
It does seem a bit excessive to require people to consider effects on glare just in case there's a passing plane up there somewhere.
Or a passing helicopter, which would be much closer to the ground.
And let's not even get into the drones, which are going to be ubiquitous. Will they all be
aircraft operations?
Well, it's an aircraft.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on.
Moving on.
But can I, on that same issue, I understand the point you make about the two Auckland airport figures. They are quite different. They deal with the figure for ground approach slope or whatever it is. It's completely different.
Yeah.
The obstacle limitation services is a completely different map to the ground lights map, and there's no way you'd want to use the obstacle map for Queenstown.
Yes.
And I presume there's no similar map on lighting at all in the designation at the moment.
No.
Queenstown.
No, there isn't. Which is why my recommendation, is to maybe if QAC can do further analysis on where the extent of glare would affect aircraft operations to come up with another figure.
So that, which is, similar, but not necessarily similar, but on the ilk that Queenstown's come up with. And then the question is, should it go in the designation alongside the other map, which is already in the designation, or should it be a rule of the plan that applies in those areas?
Yes.
Thank you.
So, paraphrasing, Commissioner said there's an issue about where the construction is. The QAC have to front with a rather more robust proxy than the obstacle limitation service, in your view.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I have. Good to go. Thank you very much, Ms. Gordon.
Thank you.
Wait.
I haven't asked my question on
too fast.
I had a question on your Wayfair one about navigation, I think it is.
Yes.
In 5.2, that must be your 42A report, you say that both the rural and the open space zones have rules requiring lighting to be directed away from adjoining sites. But when I looked at, it's on page 8, or 6, I mean, sorry. When I looked above at the rules for the open space zones, I didn't think that it included that provision. Because the rural one's got two different, well, it's got three, but it's got the lux rule, which is about how much light you're actually getting falling on your side. And then it's got a separate one that says that there must be no upward spill of light. Or no, it's got this other one that says all fixed exterior lighting must be directed away from adjoining sites and roads.
Yeah.
And that one's not in the, well, I couldn't see it in that one in the open space and recreation zone.
Yes. You are right.
Does that matter?
It could be something I think about.
Yes.
In
my life. If it doesn't matter in the end, you can say, well, that doesn't affect your recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Right, thank you.
Maybe the answer is that. The open space zone is, by definition, council land.
Well, it says, but there could be adjoining sites.
The council is trusting itself to...
To be a good neighbour.
Indeed.
Yeah. I always think that the one about lux and how much light actually falls on the adjoining site is about light coming down at you. But glare can often be about a light being directed at you, even if you don't actually get any lux, it can still be quite a distraction. Having a light aimed at you, even if it's miles away, well, not miles away, but a reasonable distance away, and it may easily meet the lux requirement, but still be a distraction for transport, navigation, or aircraft. I did much worse than you did to you yesterday.
Michael, that's it.
Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you very much, Laurie.
Thank you.
I just did a quick read of Ms. Laurie's evidence on Transpower, and it's certainly the case. It's just a matter of terminology. So there's nothing more than that, and clause 16 is entirely appropriate. Well, Mr. Chair, that takes us to the end of quite a few council experts over the week. I just do have some housekeeping to work through quickly, if that's okay.
Please do.
So, the first was a question to me as to whether the definition of resort is beyond appeal now. It is.
And it hasn't changed.
And it hasn't changed, correct. The appeal was withdrawn. There was a question as to the council advising on how it could usefully receive GIS data for structure plans and so on. Council officers are working on that, and we will get that to you in the next maybe couple of weeks. I don't think there's any urgency.
I'd say there's exactly 3 weeks.
3 weeks?
Because we'll start hearing the rural visitor zone submissions 4 weeks hence.
Certainly.
Looking forward to it.
With breath bated.
Very sad I won't be there.
You can zoom in any time
you like. Can change mine.
I think we learned that the Zoom didn't work that well. Luckily that we could all be here in person. Just to cover the information request that was issued this morning, I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. So first is a copy of the Rural Zone Environment Court Consent Memorandum. So that hasn't been issued yet, so I can provide you what we have all signed up to and filed with the court. The second you after for the rural zone a version that shows the draft consent order incorporated in it?
No. It's the effect of the orders as made.
As issued,
because we're like we had an example of that today, where the consent order the amended chapter 4 only contains the provisions that have been amended, and we're interested in effect what is the chapter 4 post in its entirety post environment court orders, but just the orders.
Okay, but
we asked for that at the end of the at the end of the hearing.
Yeah. So if we provide you with the up to date version of, let's say, chapter 4 at the hearing, assuming a consent order for chapter 4 hasn't been issued, for example, we will still just be providing you with a version of chapter 4 and the draft consent order, which is before the court, and nothing that's combined. So
that's fine if that's the case. But say there are some consent orders that have been finalised and they are actually ready, but they haven't gone into the...
Oh, certainly. Yep. Okay. Yeah.
Into the online version.
Mm-hmm.
And we have...
Absolutely.
The status of all stuff sorted at the end, and then any draft consent orders will have all those as well,
separately.
But just separately.
No.
That's what I had in mind. Appreciating that working with those inline versions of the plan as a mission, it doesn't have to be as it will appear. We're just interested in the words.
Okay, certainly. That's okay.
We don't need lots of those. I mean, if things happen in the next 7 weeks, we really only need one. By the time we come to deliberate,
unless in your view, a consent order has been issued which is particularly significant for the matters before us, and I don't know if there are any in that category, we're happy to wait to get a full set with your reply.
Okay, and I will, with your leave, just provide the draft consent order and not the pages and pages in front of it.
Correct.
Justifying it.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, you might like to know who's signed up to it, though. That's quite helpful.
Yes, that's sometimes interesting, as you say.
One more question on that. So, in particular, the strategic chapters, I'm thinking chapters 3 and 6, you have the sort of colour-coded version that we've been looking at.
Yes.
It may be that we just still have interim decisions from the Environment Court in...
As is, where is.
So I don't think that will change. So, well, I'm hopeful that it will, but
yeah.
I'm not that
realistic.
Yes, so I do wonder whether we might be able to assist by providing a version of Chapter 3, which includes all of the relevant draft consent order provisions in one place, because, for example, the colour version we've been looking at is only landscape provisions. It doesn't include urban development or indigenous biodiversity or anything like that. So we might be able to provide something that's a little bit more helpful, I think.
That would be good.
What we're trying to avoid is having 5 different versions of Chapter 3 to bounce between.
And I mean, from your point of view, the less we get muddled, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Easily put.
Because it's a huge chance. We could easily get muddled.
Certainly. And from the council's perspective, we do want to take care, particularly with interim decisions, because we understand what that means, but not all users of plan do understand what that means, and it can create a little bit of confusion. So.
Yes, understandable.
Okay.
And so probably better if, as I say, you can put all manner of watermarks over as long as we can read the words.
Okay. So just moving through, all consent orders, filed with the Environment Court. What I propose that we do, there is quite a long list and a number of those aren't relevant, I don't think. So what I intend to do is attach all of those which are relevant on the periphery of being relevant, but anything that's not relevant I'll just list, and if you would like a version of it, just ask. Otherwise, this
no, that's
is quite
you,
long list.
We don't know. That's great, thank you.
Certainly. In terms of the Waitapuna maps, so I've been advised by council officers that the best way to provide the information that you have asked for is on the online mapping application. So that can be made available to be in the hearing, and we can pull it up whenever you want to look at a particular site. There are a few Environment Court matters which are taking up GIS's time at the moment, but the council officers will do their best to provide this to you as soon as possible. Tuesday, we cannot guarantee, hopefully
just
Wednesday.
Just do the best you can. And understand that the Environment Court takes precedence. We bow ritually in the direction of Christchurch at this point.
And then just around that information request of the universal deed, my instructions have changed and I can now provide that to you.
Oh. That will be as well. Thank you. We will await a copy with eager anticipation.
Thank you. So two more things that I have on my list anyway. I think early on, possibly somewhere, we've mentioned that we will provide updated accept reject tables with the council's right of reply. We've done that in the past. I think the intention is still to do that. Of course, the accept reject tables that you have sit with our Section 42A's. There will need to be some changes given.
Well, there have already been some changes there.
Through rebuttal, that's right.
Through rebuttal.
No,
that was the intention at one at the
start. One at the end. Yes.
And then just the reply date.
Well, we have arranged that we will be deliberating the week of the 14th of September. I think we'd need it a week beforehand.
Certainly.
Thank you. So if we're
7th.
So the 7th.
Excellent. Sounds good to me. And we appreciate a little bit more than the 2 weeks that was already penciled in. And that is all I have on my list.
Well, thank you very much for you and your junior, who I see is a runner, late to arrive and quick to leave, and of course the entire council team. It's been a massive effort, and I think we're well across the issues now.
Thank you
for your time. We'll adjourn the hearing, reforming 9 a.m. coming Tuesday,
the 7th.
Tuesday the 7th.